Okay, it's 8:31. Oh, I see. Also wish to Mazda. Okay, everyone, so let me begin. I want to begin with a couple things, as always, from previous classes. First, when one person emails me, I assume this is for one. If one person has the question, probably five others also do. So we spoke, last class dealt a lot with history, and Reb Nachum Shemariyahu, thank you for your long email. I won't have time to get into it in the details, but I did want to say, people asked me, I quoted this book by a Fund. I think I called him Meir Fund. It's actually Yosef Fund. It's this book, if anyone's interested. It's called, it's the Separation or Erud Hishtatfut, Agudas Yisrael, opposite the religious Zionism and the State of Israel, published in 98, I think. He wrote another book called, here it is, The Leadership of Agudas Yisrael Faced with the Holocaust. He teaches, I don't know if he teaches at any universities. I think he teaches at Michelah, actually. This was published in 2008. Unfortunately, and this is a problem sometimes people have, in 2007, right before his book came out, another book came out by Dr. Chaim Shalem. Actually, I see on the back, he teaches at Michelah. And it's the same thing. It was so to Agudas Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael, Lenochah HaShoah. It's the same thing. Money to Agudas Yisrael, Lenochah HaShoah. It's tough to work so long on a book, and then two people wrote the exact. What happened in those cases is because they're both using the same archives. My experience has been usually in the middle, they realize that they find out someone else is working on the same thing, and you're not going to stop. After all, yours might be better. But that's the books if anyone's interested. I want to show you something now. We have a lot of people listening on YouTube and online. So I want to thank Daniel from Chicago for sending me what I'm going to show you right now. Actually, before I get to that, people are still asking how to get the book we're going to be looking at in just 2 minutes. Here it is. You can see for those on YouTube, they said they can't see the chat. So here you see it. You can just Google this. So you can email me if you want to get it and follow it. You can buy it on eBay. What I wanted to show. Oh, hold, no. What I wanted to. And I thank Daniel from Chicago. Let's see. I gotta. Sorry, I have to stop sharing and reshare again. Here. This is Beis Yaakov in St. Louis. So you see, there they are. They're the, I guess, the principal in the middle, but the girls are wearing the gowns. That's Beis Yaakov of St. Louis. As long as we're focusing on pictures, let me show you a couple of others. What I have to do, it seems, is you have to share each one separately on this Zoom thing. We spoke about the Rav Soloveitchik's funeral. Here is a picture of the funeral. Thank you, David Eisen, for sending it to me. David actually thought that he spotted me right here. You see? I have to say, though, it's not me. If it, just because the hair is, it's not, there's more of a bald spot on mine. But this is a picture. Here you have, my cursor's working, Chaim Soloveitchik. There's Professor Torsky, Mrs. Torsky. I don't know who that is. I think that's the Rav's sister. There's Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. You have Dr. Lamb there, Mrs. Lichtenstein. You have Rav Aaron, the grandchildren, Ramosha Torsky, Shem Yikom Damo, and Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's children. Henry Feuerstein, for those who know Boston, the son of Mo Feuerstein. Dr. Kosofsky. I called that the Abe Leibovitz, who was the principal, president of Maimonides, maybe 25 years. I mistakenly called him doctor last class. He wasn't a doctor. Oh, and there is Mark Gopin. I'm certain of that, who we've spoke about in the past. You can watch the Meir Kahana videos from Brandeis, and you see him, Rabbi Mark Gopin, an old Boston family. And there's other people I could point out in the picture as well. As far as I know, this is the only picture taken of the funeral, like this sort of scene. Okay, what else do I want to show you? Someone emailed me. I mentioned, oh, getting back to the funeral. I announced publicly last week that the Rav Aaron Soloveitchik published something in the Allgemeiner Journal. I remember it very well, but I haven't seen it. No one has it. The family, actually, in Israel told me they don't have a copy of it. And this, so I was bereft. How am I going to find it? Who knows if the Allgemeiner Journal even has any archive anymore? Lo and behold, someone listening to the show, Yehuda Schneider, whose grandfather was a big Rav in Talmud Chacham, not a big Rav in terms of pulpit, but a big Talmud Chacham, a student of Yeshivas Rebbitzin Chanan in the early years, author of numerous Sfarim, he saved a copy. And it remained in, he passed away, but the family has it. He sent me a PDF of it. It's a very long article. He also goes after the Jewish Observer, but it's mostly going after this other Mechutzof who attacked the Rav and defended not going to the funeral. So if anyone's interested in that, it's called In Defense of My Brother. I will send that to you. It's this could be what they call in the library world a unicum. It might be the only copy in existence in the world. So I'm going to be putting it up on. I'll do a blog post. I'll make a note of this. It's important for me to make get it online so people could see it. But in the meantime, I'm happy to send anyone a copy of this. It's great stuff. And as for the Rav, I mentioned that he was very good friends with Rav Ruderman. So someone emailed me, well, what do I mean by good friends? Someone asked me in class, what do I mean? And during the class, what do I mean by friends? And I said they would talk before Yontif. Okay, let me clarify something. When I say friends, I don't mean friends like we have friends. The Rav, and I don't think he's unique in this. I think it's true about a lot of the big rabbis. But the Rav in particular, he wrote about how lonely he was. He didn't have friends like we have friends. I know sometimes people say because he was so much greater, he couldn't, but it's just his personality was a very lonely personality. And you often, for people at the top like that, they don't have friends the way we think of friends. I'm sure that even with the rabbis he's friends with, it was always very formal. They say with Shaul Lieberman, he was on a first name basis. They were also related because Shaul Lieberman is also in the Nitziv's family. His father-in-law's were Meir Bar Ilan. So the Shaul Berlin can call the Rav Beryl. He can call him Shaul, but it's we don't have friends like we think of. So thank you, Yehuda Schneider, for that. Two more things. I mentioned to you about the story, the famous story of Moshe Soloveitchik, and he said, "Well, my son's great, but no one's as great as my father, Reb Chaim." And I wasn't sure who said it. I thought maybe Rabbi Shurin, and then Shiner. I marked down his name. He says, "No, it was Rav Natan Greenblatt. He was quoting his father." Actually, Shiner, you're halfway right. I'm going to show you it. I found it. I know where I saw it now. It was actually Rav Nutta, but he wasn't quoting his father. He's quoting Rabbi Leon Katz of Passaic. If we have any Passaic people, he lived in Passaic like 50 years. He was the son of Rav Reuven Katz, who we did Torah and Motion classes on, the Degel Reuven of Petach Tikva. I grew up actually eating hot dogs he gave Hashgacha to, because if you grew up in the New York area, this is before there was such thing as Glatt or anything like that. ShopRite hot dogs, believe it or not, where we never ate Hebrew National. Even growing up, we didn't eat it, but ShopRite hot dogs under the Hashgacha of Rabbi Leon Katz, everyone ate them. Label, he was known. So here I'm going to play you. Listen to, oh, let me get the sound. Hold on, I got to get sound good again. About a minute and a half of Rav Nutta Greenblatt telling the story in his own words, like only Rav Nutta can. Maybe another time I'll tell you about Rav Nutta. I actually put online something from Rav Nutta. So listen carefully.
Label kids in America called Leon. It was a Passaic maybe 50 years. But he learned at YU, Yeshiva Sabbath Lohona, he learned Baram Moshe. So he once, one time he took a walk with Rav Moshe, and Rav Moshe was lauding Rav Yeshiver. He was telling him how great he is.
Yeah.
Berlin, the son. So he had a big mouth. Zakta, he tells me. So I say to him, maybe he's as big with a tate.
So Rav Yeshiver like a Zeta, right?
He said this was on Amsterdam Avenue. That's a big street in New York.
Yeah.
So he says Rav Moshe stopped. And he started to shout. zum Taten kommt keiner nicht.
That's it.
To my father,
no one
comes. Yes. It's in two ways. Das wissen der Pshazok label. Das meint das ist, Rabbi Shaber would get there, but nobody can be like a Chaim. Do you understand what I mean?
There.
Zum Taten kommt keiner nicht. Das ist Brisk. Sis Takebel.
Okay, so there you go. Thank you, Shiner, for reminding me, even though it was, it's Rev. Leon Katz. Incidentally, Rabbi Katz's son, one of his sons, there have even been people, once on my tour, I told the story, and there was someone who was in Baltimore at the time. There was a yeshiva, Chavetz Chaim, there. I don't know if it still exists. They had a fire in the 60s or 70s. I forget which one it was. And two cousins were killed. One of them was Rabbi Katz's son. He was killed in the fire, and then his cousin. If we have people from Baltimore, maybe you remember that terrible fire. Okay, there's one more thing. I still haven't gotten to it. Ruvain from Paris. Maybe we'll get to it next week on the fasting, but I want to get back to the book. So we're picking up. I think we might even finish Yoredeya today. We're holding in page 127, Simon Nun Gimel. This isn't not really one of the questions that the world depends on. It has to do with Bizayon disgracing Sforim by turning him upside down, because the Shulchan Aruch, the Rama says, you can't put a book upside down. So my question was, what does that mean, upside down, and what does the word Asur mean? I mean, is it really a sore that you have to go around and take all your books and turn them over? And this question goes to Rabbi Feinhandler. We spoke about Rabbi Feinhandler in the past. And first of all, he raises the question, what does it mean upside down? If you turn a sefer so the back is pushed up, is that upside down? He thinks that really it comes down to what's regarded as manechshav bizayon lefiyam akubal. What is considered improper? And he says that, look, to go into a base medrash and turn up all the books, I mean, that's a tircha gadola, he says. It's a nice thing to do, but it's hard to say that it's actually obligatory. And then he brings some other examples. He doesn't really see it so much as halacha, as just if you can do it, do it. He says, interesting, though, in the second to last paragraph, he actually speaks of what does it mean, what's considered proper. So you might say, well, he looks at Sefer Torah. You know, what is a Sefer Torah? If we lay it down, is that improper? Not sure if it's on the ground, but if you leave it, let's say, flat, in our own Kodesh, we leave it, we stand it up. He notes, though, however, this is actually a machlokas. The same machlokas about a mezuzah. Does the mezuzah go straight or does it go sideways? Rabbeinu Tam, who held the mezuzah should be like horizontal, he actually held that in our own Kodesh, the Torah should be held horizontally. And so he just raises that as a side point that we know you can't leave it if it disgraces it. So it doesn't really give you any bichidushim. However, what I subsequently found is Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin, in his B'nai Vonim, volume 1, page 209, he says very interestingly that, first of all, it doesn't mean holding a book like this, upside down. Because that's not upside down. That's when you're however you do it, the words are from the right side or facing up, whether it's this way or that way. He says upside down is like this. That's what Bizayud is. And you shouldn't leave a book like that. However, to leave it facing the other way, he says that if you're towards the end of the book and you close it, that's the way it closes. And it's he doesn't see that as a problem. Okay, again, that's not, and he says Rav Henkin, his grandfather, agreed with that. But he says where people see it as a problematic matter, then don't do it in front of other people. Okay, that's, not all the questions are, I would say, earth-shattering, but now we're going to get into some really interesting ones, at least not the next one. It's not earth shattering, but it's of interest. This is to the great Rav Herschel Schechter, number 54. I had asked him as questions, and he replies. This is not from the 80s. This is just maybe from about 10 years ago. I don't have a date on it. First thing, I want to tell you what he says in his book. Rav Schechter wrote this book, Nefesh HaRav, which, although it's now published in 93, so 94. So you're talking 26 years. It still has the flavor. It's still, I still love going back to that book because he has a way of putting things which are just, it makes it really a very interesting read. And the book, you can go on Otsar HaChachma and plug the name of the book in, and you see it's made all sorts of inroads, even into the Haredi world. And they cite it. Plagiarized also because sometimes he quotes traditions from Reb Chaim, and certain people want to quote it, but they can't say where they got it from because he's a YU guy, so of course he's puzzled. So you can, in one of my blog posts, I actually mentioned a sefer that plagiarized from Nefesh HaRav. Okay, that's par for the course. But he says as follows. I know some people found this a strange passage, even perhaps disrespectful to the Taz. The Taz is the great commentator in the Shulchan Aruch. But this is what he says on page 19. He says that when we began to study Yoredeya, the Rav taught Yoredeya. Later on, the Rav didn't. They gave it to other people, including especially Rav Yosef Weiss. Rav Yosef Weiss was a Rosh Hashiva at YU for 60 years maybe. And he would teach Yoredeya, and other people taught it. But the Rav originally would teach Yoredeya. And he says that the Gra being the famous Gaon of Vilna, he said, the Gra said that when the Shach wrote his commentary in the Shulchan Aruch, Shach is also one of the big commentaries, there was the Vad Arba Aratzos was powerful. That was this big organization that of the leaderships of communities that could pass all sorts of rules. One of the things they passed was that they determined what masechta all the yeshivas would be learning so that they could be printed and everyone could get them, because it would be a big balagan if every little town was learning a different masechta. And it says that one of the things they made was that you couldn't print a book without getting haskamas from the leaders of the great rabbis. In those days, haskamas were not like today. Today, a haskama is approbation, basically saying that it's not even saying there's nothing bad in the book. It's saying that I know the author, because almost always they say that I'm too busy, I can't read the book, but I know the author, he's reliable. But originally, haskamot were about so that you couldn't reprint something and steal someone's works. Like if I reprint a Talmud, I get a haskama on it that until I sell out, no one else could just take my typesetting and do the same thing. Or if I'm printing my father's book, no one else could do that. It was basically copyright. And then it says that the Shach gave his work to the Taz, who was the eldest rabbi, to get him get a haskama from him. And the Taz saw that the Shach's work was better than his own work, and he didn't want to permit him to publish it. Look, the Rav told the story, I get it, but it's hard to imagine that the Taz, although the Gemara says that one is jealous of everyone is jealous except chutz mi benov talmido. You're jealous of everyone except for your child, your son. It says son, but it means child. That is, we want our children to do better than us, and we're not going to be jealous if they have greater achievements than us, and rather we'll have pride. And also talmido. They say maybe the Chazal, I know of at least a couple cases that I'd say the Chazal were being a little perhaps too kind in their reading of it, because there have been cases where people have been jealous of their talmidim, at least in one case. But as general rule, Chazal speak in general rules, there's always exceptions. So if your student does better than you, is greater than you, you feel pride in this. So in that sense, the Taz is able to feel jealousy, the Shach is in his student. And Chazal say that everyone can have jealousy. The only one you don't have it on is with your child and your student. But still, it's a bit of a shocking thing to say. But what can I say? The Rav said it and Schechter printed it, which is interesting because in a Haredi work, they wouldn't have printed it probably. They in a Haredi in particular, they protect the rabbis from themselves. Well, on the one hand, the rabbis are mostly Das Torah, and whatever they say is the ultimate, but yet they won't print stuff that the Gedolim say if they don't think it will reflect well on the Gedolim. So they become the censors of the Gedolim. It's a fascinating phenomenon. For instance, in the Hebrew biography of Rav Yol Yoshev, they portray him as very cold and distant because he's always involved in learning. And maybe that works for an Israeli reader. But for an American reader, even the Haredi world, you read this and you're really going to be turned off. So when Art Scroll translated it, they left out all this stuff. It's like they're censoring the Gedolim for themselves. But so he puts it in, I think, for Schechter for doing it. And And it says, Vigal Cain, and because of this, Nenashataz Minashamayim, that the Taz, God punished the Taz. Why? That in Yoredeya, we decide in most cases like the Shach, not like the Taz, who was the elder. And in Orachayim, we paskin like the Magen Avraham, not like the Taz. And in Evan, Ezra, Hoshin, Mishpat, if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, the Taz is not even the main commentary on the sides of the Shulchan Aruch. He's down at the bottom. So that was the punishment in the tradition that the Gros said for the Taz for not wanting to let the Shach publish his work because he didn't want to be overshadowed. And then he quotes the Rav as saying that this is a true story. How do I know it's true? It's not a Bab Maisa because I heard it from my father. That's like the Guzari proof. My father would have, doesn't change the fact that maybe if the father heard the Bab Maisa and repeated it, but that's what he says. And then he says, and because of this, the Rav for many, for most of the year, we'd only learn the Taz a little bit. And most of the time, we'd be learning the Shach. Now, in the third edition of Nefesh HaRav, he says, I heard from some students of the Rav that they heard the story completely differently. So he told me the story here. I didn't include the, I'll tell you now, the entire letter from Rav Schechter. I have an ellipsis. I didn't include everything. I know he didn't want me to include something that was said there, so maybe off the record I can tell you he didn't want it published about these students. But he says that one of the students of Soloveitchik, who lives in Israel, you could probably figure out who these students are, sent me a letter in his name and the name of another student also living in Israel. They're younger than me. They were not even the in yeshiva, Rabbi Tzalchana, in the days that I was there in the early years when we weren't by Soloveitchik. They claimed that they know more better than me. One of these people he's speaking about, by the way, said after Rav Tova Lichtenstein gave a talk about her father, this person said that, told Tova Lichtenstein that I knew your father in his matter better than you did because I learnt with him in yeshiva. So again, we don't need to identify them. You probably know if you know the scene in Israel, you know what I'm talking about. The Rav had two in particular, really Haredi students in the 1970s, who didn't go to YU, but they just wanted to learn by the Rav. And one of them in particular has published a lot of stuff. And then he said that they said to Rav Schechter, we know more than you about the story. And the story is incorrect that you tell. And then they also said, Rav Schechter said about Mitzitza. Mitzitza, where you use the mouth to suck out the blood, and Mila. Rav Schechter said something which I acknowledge is strange. And I wrote to him originally because it didn't seem like it could make sense to me. But what he quotes the Rav as saying is Das Rabbeinu Haisa Dibizmanaze Ein Sarach Mitzitza Klal, that we don't need to do Mitzitza at all. Mitzitza, according to most, is understood as a medical thing. It's just medicine. It's not part of the Mila. However, there have been people who do think it's part of the Mila. And once the reformers wanted to get rid of Mila, there were reformers. There was a backlash. And all of a sudden, you have Orthodox rabbis saying things like Mitzitza is halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai, which is very strange because none of the Rishonim say that. No one says that until the reformers want to start getting rid of Mila. And if they can't get rid of Mila, get rid of Mitzitza. Then all of a sudden, people are saying it's halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai. So you see clearly as an outsider that other forces are leading this. If you look at all the early sources, it seems pretty clear that it's just for medical reasons. They thought it was medical reasons. Where Moshe Sternbach has published a thing just a couple days ago, because in Israel, they're saying not to do Mitzitza now. Genius. You don't have to be a genius. Know that now is not the right time during Corona to do Mitzitza, where now there's any physical contact. But there are communities that are fighting back against this, and Ramosha Sternbach is one of them. And he says that we know that Mitzitza has to be part of Mila, an essential element. How? Because it's so disgusting. That's what he says, Dovermos, that no one would ever do this if it wasn't commanded as part of the Mila. I don't buy that argument, because what we think of as repulsive today, other times we'll not think of it as repulsive at all. I even had a post in which I gave example of things that would be regarded as quite repulsive today, but in previous years were not. And I'm going to return to that as well. But this is a strange thing, I think, quoting from the Rav, because I have never heard anyone in the Lithuanian world in particular say that you don't need Mitzitza. even if it was for medical reasons. Instead, they, in the Lithuanian world, they're very quick to adopt different tubes and things like that. And then he added that in the third edition, he heard from one of the students of the Rav that he didn't actually say that. He just said, you don't do mitzitza bepeh. And that's what Chaim Brisker said not to do. Okay, so that's, I believe in that case, they might be right. But I asked Rav Schechter a question. If we assume, as he does, that mitzitza is not part of the essence of bris milah, it's only a medical thing. So fine, so even if we don't believe in the medicine, that it has a medical reason, it's a minhag, so we still do it. We don't do it with the mouth, we do it with the tube or something. But if that's the case, how do you do this on Shabbos? It violates Shabbos. You can't do a medical procedure like that on Shabbos for a variety of reasons. So why would we do mitzitz on Shabbos? And Rav Schechter replies to me that this question I asked, Kasha, chazaka ma'od. It's a difficult question, because on the one hand, you can't get rid of mitzitza. It's part of, everyone does it, and we've all been doing it. On the other hand, if we don't think it helps at all medically, and we're just doing it like for nostalgic type reasons, how could we do it on Shabbos? And he provides a possible answer, but it's only based on the Zohar. He said, the Zohar, he quotes in the Mishkan Bas Yaakov, that there's three aspects to Mila. We all know about Mila and then Priya, but there's also Hatafistan Bris. You have to actually draw some blood. And the Zohar says that it's part of it. And if it wasn't for this Zohar, we would say that the only time you do Hatafistan Bris is when someone who already is circumcised converts to Judaism. Then we know you have to do Hatafistan Bris. But the Zohar tells us, and that became the general practice, that in every Bris Mila you have to. And Rav Schechter wants to say that mitzitza, even if it's not needed for refuah, should be regarded, at least according to the Zohar, as actually part of the milah as hatafastan bris, according to the Zohar. And therefore, we can justify doing it based on the Zohar. The classical explanations for why you do mitzitza, that it's refuah, we wouldn't be allowed to, but since the Zohar does see it as part of the mila attached to the Tafistan Bris, because it has to do with the blood, I guess, that at least we can rely on the Zohar to still do it on Shabbos. That's what he says. And then he concludes the letter. He's trying to explain how perhaps he could be challenged on certain points. He didn't get it 100% accurate. And I don't think he's correct on the thing about mitzitza. I don't think the Rav ever would have said that you don't have to do mitzitza at all. The Rav might have said, I think, that technically you don't need to do mitzitza because it's all refuah, but I don't think the Rav ever said that practically you can get away without doing it. He says, 99% of the book, Nefesh HaRav, I wrote based on memory. Remember, he wrote it to come out within the year, the Yortzeit year. Without even looking at my writings. There could be mistakes here and there. So he acknowledges that he wrote the book, he wrote it quickly, he wrote it without going back to all the sources, and it's possible there could be mistakes. I think that's an important acknowledgement. I've mentioned in the class certain things that I think are in error. In one case, I know it's an error, but those have always been examples where at the end he says, shamati. That is, he reports something he heard. Okay, so that is, he's reporting he heard. Where he actually claims that I was there, like in this case, or he doesn't say that actually at Matzitza. He's just repeating what he knows as a Talmud. That's a little harder to say, but okay. Adkan Siman Nundal. Now we get into an important issue. One of the most important issues of our day. We've been living through it the last 20 years, and that has to do with conversion. What is the definition of a conversion? Why is it that all of a sudden, in the last 15 years, 20 years or so, less than 20, 15 years, you hear about canceling of conversions? No one ever heard of this growing up. What is a conversion? We have people from America, people in Canada. You know what it means to conversion? You go to the local rabbi in Winnipeg, San Francisco, wherever it is, he's convinced that this person coming to him wants to be a Jew. He puts together a Beis Din. If there's other rabbis in town, he puts together the other rabbis. If not, he gets the chazan or two religious balabak team, and they convert the person. And that's how Jews have been converted since time immemorial. Now, this idea that you have conversion courts and that the chief rabbinate says you're not accepted. They don't accept your conversion if you don't go to one of the authorized conversion courts. I never understood what that means. Does that mean that They don't accept Satmar conversions, for instance. If it's an independent Satmar based and that the person doesn't need to fast on Yom Kippur, what does that mean they don't accept? Okay, maybe the state of Israel doesn't accept it, but why? What is that language? So we're having all these issues going on with conversion. And what if you get through all the politics, what it comes down to is what is required for a conversion when it comes to acceptance of mitzvot. It's clear in the Gemara and the Rambam that you need to accept the mitzvot. Boas mitzvot. You need mila for a man, tevila for a man and woman, and acceptance of mitzvot. What does that mean, accept mitzvot? Does that mean you'll never sin? Does that mean you accept the mitzvot knowing that you're going to be like everyone else and you're going to sin? What about if you you say, well, yeah, I accept the mitzvot, but if you're asking me honestly, I am going to tell Lashon Hara that we're going to say it's not a valid conversion. Religious Jews tell Lashon Hara. Ramosha Feinstein said it can't mean what people think it means, everything, because Ramosha says if someone converts and he's honest and tells the base, and I don't think I could give up my life. If someone puts a gun to my head and says, bow down to the cross, which you're leaving, or I'll kill you. Of course, we know that's hard to offer. And the person says, I don't think, honestly, I could give up my life, and I probably would violate it, like most Jews would. Does that make you not Jewish? Ramosha says, of course not. It doesn't make you not Jewish. So what does it mean? And what about... if you only find out about that later. So this is a huge issue. I'm not going to go into it so much. We'll see. I'll see what the tshuva says. But that's what the issue is all about. And I can tell you that there are views on both sides. Since we're coming out of Toronto here, Rabbi Price, who was in Montreal, he was in Toronto, right? Rabbi Price. Rabbi Price had a very liberal view on this. He wrote these sfarim, these giant sfarim, this heaviest sfarim I've ever seen. And in his commentary on Sefer Hasidim, he says that we know that most of the people we convert are not going to be observant, but it doesn't matter. As long as they say publicly they're accepting the Torah, Devarim should believe in Devarim, what they think privately doesn't matter, and they'll be punished like any sinning Jew. So that was the opinion of many. Others hold, this isn't something new invented by the Haredim, others hold that no, if you have reason to believe that the person who's converting is trying to pull a fast one over on the basin and doesn't really intend to observe the mitzvot. We don't say as long as they verbally say it, they have to really mean it. That doesn't mean they won't sin or anything, but they have to mean that they accept the mitzvot. Then it's not binding. And even after the fact, if we see, not 20 years later, like we see now, but we see them in 2 weeks, being Bechal Shabbos, we can say that they never accepted it. Rabbi Price said, well, his attitude is they don't need to, they need to accept the idea of Shabbos. Doesn't mean that they're going to do it. So this is a major machlokas. And then the question is, what about b'diavad? A lot of people hold you need to get this at the beginning, but b'diavad, if they don't, and I'll show you a proof from the Rambam they bring, it's still a valid conversion. So that's what the basic dispute is all about. So what was this tshuva? The next tshuva is a letter from this rabbi. Many of you have heard of him, not that one, Rav Chaim Amsalem. Let me tell you about Rav Chaim Amsalem, who's one of the most interesting figures in the last 10 years in Israel. He's from Algeria, a Moroccan family that made its way to Algeria, Oran. As a youth, he came to Israel, and he ended up learning in Rav Mazuz's yeshiva, Kisei Rachami, in Bnei Brak. I can tell you, he's a very big Talmud Chacham. Unlike he was in the Shas party, I'll talk about it in a second, but he's been a practicing Rav. He's an author of books out here. He has numerous Sfarim, including two very big volumes of Responsa, Minchat Chaim. He served as the Rav of the Sephardic community in Geneva for a number of years. When he went to Kisei Rachmi in Bnei Brak, it was a very small yeshiva. Now it's the largest Sephardic yeshiva, if you count all its branches, it's the largest, I believe. I don't think there's any question. It's the largest in Israel because it's in Bnei Brak, but it has branches all over Israel now. Horat Yosef doesn't have branches. Yechavadat doesn't have branches. And that's really the Tunisian tradition. He was just a typical rabbi. He didn't make any waves or anything. And then he was in Geneva. And the Shas party, which is very powerful and kept getting lots of seats. They wanted to give a representative to Rabbi Mazuz and his community, Kisei Rachamim B'nei Brak, especially since Rabbi Mazuz was one of the great defenders of Rav Avadi Yosef. So the Talmud Mufak of Rabbi Mazuz is Rabbi Amsalom. Now the problem with people like Rabbi Mazuz and Rabbi Soloveitchik, I say problem in quotes, is that, and Rabbi Mazuz is more on the Haredi side, obviously, than the Rav, but both of them have never believed in this idea of cloning students and just do what I tell you to do. And that's dangerous because then you get students who come up with independent ideas that could make waves. So Rabbi Soloveitchik has certain students who say opposite things, and some are radical on the right and on the left. But, well, Rabbi Mazuz had that problem also, or problem in quotes, if you want to put it, because Rabbi Amsalom, first couple of years, he's in the Shas party. He's one of the deputies, and he's not making any waves. And not only is he not making any waves, he's the posek when they can't get Rav Avadia to decide on little matters, because he's the Talmud Chacham. The Shas deputies, they're not Talmidei Chacham. I mean, they're just people appointed. If you want to see a great video, you got to see this video of the guy, the Shas deputy, the Shas member of Knesset who was fired. This is after Avadia Yosef passed away. They fired him because he went to his gay nephew's wedding. And this is a guy, he represented the Shas party. But he did a whole interview, did a whole hour show on him. And this is just a guy. He comes, a traditional guy who becomes more religious, but he's still, you know, these guys go to the army. And he represents the old-time Sephardic people, and he's listening to regular music. It's a very different, they're not like the Ashkenazi. But around 2009, Rabbi Amsalom, remember, who's a big Talmid Chacham, and everyone's speaking about the Russian Aliyah. And all these Russians are coming in, and they're not religious. They're not Jewish. And they're going into the army. Young people are going into the army, and they're Israelis. And in everyone's mind, they're Jewish. They're just not luckily Jewish. The father's Jewish. And they're Hebrew speakers. So for the first time, you have the possibility of assimilation in the state of Israel. You never had that before, because occasionally, once in a blue moon, you had a German girl, you know, they come to the kibbutzim and someone would fall in love. But in those days, they would actually convert them. I know someone whose daughter, I'm not going to say who he is, people will know who he is, but his son married a German girl and they converted him. The Rabbanu converted, and he's not religious, and she's not religious. But in those days, Rav Gorin was very open to this. But we're not dealing with this now. And obviously we're not dealing with the Arabs, who there's no intermarriage really with. These are Russians. So Rabbi Amsalom said, we need a new approach. And we need to convert all these Russians. Now, how can you convert all these Russians? They're not going to observe mitzvot. So he developed the idea that the old approach, that it really doesn't matter. This is Rav Uziel and others, even Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski to a certain extent, not with certain traditional Jews, not or Rav Chaim Ozer would convert traditional people, not secularists, but Rav Uziel would even convert people who was clear they weren't going to observe mitzvot. And Rav Amsalom says it's a shat adchak, and we need to do that. And the Haredim start attacking him left and right, and because he was making this idea public. And Rav Avadi Yosef starts feeling very worried. Now, Rav Amsalom, they wrote a whole book of his conversations, and he claims that they never let him in to speak to Rav Avadi Yosef. So they just fed him information. And he blames his fall through Aryeh Deri. And he claims that had he spoke to Rav Avadi, everything would be different. I don't know, but Rav Avadi starts getting very nervous. And then Rav Amsalom really goes off the deep end. He starts speaking about how we have to, that this culture we have of the learning society, where all religious Haredi people do is sit and learn in yeshiva and don't work. He says, that's terrible. That's the Ashkenazic way. That's not the Sephardic way. And this is a distortion of traditional Judaism, and it's turning Sephardim into Batlanim. And even for the Ashkenazim, he says it's terrible. So he starts pushing this thing that yeshivas and kolels should only be for elites. But the whole yeshiva system should be shut down in terms of as a mass movement. And that, it's not the Sephardic way, and the Sephardim know best, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this is crossing a red line, and Rav Avadia was convinced that this is enough, and he told Rav Amsalom, you're fired. He kicked him out of the Shas party, and Rav Amsalom did what is unheard of, impossible. He said, I refuse to leave. He says, I earned this seat. I was elected. We elected people who supported me, voted for it, knowing I'm running, and I'm not leaving. And he remained a Shas deputy, even though he had been fired, and he was basically put in Cherem. He remained a Shas deputy until that government ended. And then after that, he tried to get elected on his own party. He has a group called Am Shalem. Mark Angel, by the way, is a big supporter of his now. He really, to a certain degree, some of his views really went very much to the left. Because it's typical, when since he's being attacked so much by the right wing, who was welcoming him? The left wing. So he found like a home in the left wing. And since then, he's published a lot of stuff, very liberal. He came out in favor of the Zoom Seder and all sorts of things. He's really very much, he's on the Basin. He was on with Reverend Rabinovich to convert children. And he tried to start to get elected to Knesset. It didn't work. He ran for the chief rabbin of Jerusalem. Didn't get it. He hasn't been successful at all. He's on one of the lists for the next election, but I don't know if he'll ever serve again. He doesn't have that much drawing power because the people who like him really vote for National Religious Party and things. I wouldn't count him out. He might be back in government, but that's Rabbi Amstel. Now, during the dispute, before he started going after yeshiva students and say, get them out of the base medrashes if they're not top and they should, because that he's right, though. It never was a Sephardic approach, but it never was an Ashkenazic approach either until the Begin government came in and they made a deal with the Haredim to support Likud. They'd give everyone a blank check not to go to the army. You never had the mass yeshiva movement like this. He published two volumes right at the beginning of the dispute over his view that we can convert all these Russians. And here's the first volume. It's called Zera Yisrael. Zera Yisrael. Why is it called Zera Yisrael? Because one of his basic ideas is that with the Russians, we're not just dealing with non-Jews. We're dealing with people who are Zera Yisrael. This goes back to a dispute. Those who heard the classes under Zera Hildesheimer might remember. Are you allowed to convert circumcision to a child of a Jewish father and non-Jewish mother to make it easier for later on him to convert? Rav Israel Hildesheimer said, no, he's a guy. Child's a guy. And Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, and not just him, others as well, Rav Uziel says it, have this idea based, I think, also on Kabbalistic ideas, that it's not just Jew and non-Jew. There's a third category, Zera Yisrael. A Jewish man who has a child with a non-Jewish woman, the child is not Jewish, but it's not just like a non-Jew. It's Zera Yisrael. There's holy Jewish seed, and it's considered a holy task for certain people to bring that back into the Jewish fold. And therefore, there's precedence that you can be more liberal in how you relate to them. He published a second volume at the same time, Mikor Yisrael, thick book, which has just copies of all the sources that support him on this. One of them is actually, I just opened it, you'll see. Anyone know who this is? Shari Tor. Just quickly, if anyone knows who that is, to write it in. The author, he's just copying pages from this book. Any old, why you guys remember of Shmuel Volk? Or Shmuel Volk has a sefer, in one of his sefarim, in his sefer, Shari Tor, he deals with the fact a liberal view, you can't void a conversion or anything like that. Rav Shmuel Volk, just for people who are, I mentioned this once, I'll say it again, the YU doesn't want to remember by Volk. So much so that they have a little book they put out some years ago, like a booklet, in which they have all the Rosh Yeshiva who ever served at YU, and Rav Volk is not even included in it. And there's a picture, which YU published years ago, which they didn't identify him, even though he's sitting there right in the middle. Now, how is Rav Shmuel Volk? He's a Telzer, by the way. If you went to YU, remember him. Why is he persona non grata at YU? He sued YU. He sued in the secular court because he had an illness, and he took time off, and they didn't want his time for him to come back after he recovered from his illness. They didn't have a position for him, and I think they held anyway. It was time for him to retire. He was old, and they created a big machlokas, and he might have gone to Basin first. I don't remember. Or he got a Hector to go sue them. Whatever it is, he sued YU over this. And if you look at the introduction to the Shari Tor, he attacks Belkin. Unbelievable the way he attacks Belkin. It's I don't even want to repeat what he says about Dr. Belkin. And he attacks the Rav too. he really goes after the Rav, Rabbi Rakefet. Rakefet was a Talmud of Rabbi Volk. In his memoir, From Washington Street to Washington Avenue or something, whatever it's called, he recalls that once when he was in class, you know, the Rav would give shiur, and they would, in those days, I don't know if they did every class, but they'd bring in, they'd tape him. And Rav Volk said, well, I don't understand. Why aren't they taping my shiur? He says, I went to the gymnasium and Tells. You know, Tells had a gymnasium. They got a second time like today, where Tells is like on the right. Tells was a liberal place in terms of yeshivas. They had a machina, Hebrew speaking, they had a secular education. I think Rakefet writes in his book, you know, Rabbi, it was sad, because Rabbi Volk didn't appreciate his difference between a PhD from the University of Berlin and going to the gymnasium, which is like high school, in Tells. But and it's a shame, Rabbi, he would have, Rakefet says, had it not been a Holocaust, you know, he might have been the Rosh Hashiva of Tells. He was in the family there. And one more thing, he would always make fun of Tells in Cleveland. He said, that's not the real Tells. So he was an interesting character. I know he has grandchildren in Lakewood and other things, but he had a very difficult relationship with YU. He actually was quite friendly. I heard this from Rackman. He and Rackman were quite friendly. Now in this Sefer, the whole point of this Sefer is to argue for the liberal approach to convert the Russians, that you don't need to accept in practice halacha, you just need to accept the mitzvot. It doesn't mean you're actually going to do them. He says you should try to make sure they're traditional, but even if they're not, at the end of the day, you don't void a conversion. Who does it have haskamas from? Before I get to the big one, it has Rav Shar Yashiv Cohen. It has Rav Shlomo Duchovsky. Shlomo Duchovsky was a based in very interesting figure. Rav Dov Lior, Rav of Kiryat Arba, Rav Zalman Nachemya Goldberg, Rav Abrigel, also Rav Nachem Rabinovich, Rav Yaakov Ariel. Now some of these, the more Haredi ones, Rav Duchovsky, Rav Zalman Nachemya Goldberg, and also Rav Dov Lior, actually, when the controversy over the Rav Emsalem became so strident, they retracted their haskamah. Said, I just gave the haskamah in theoretical, not practical. Okay, they retracted it. But the big one is Rabbi Mazuzis. So let me read you what. It's really not about the Rav Amsalam making up something. And before I do that, I want to show you that even though Rabbi Amsalam and Rabbi Mazuz had a falling out, at least publicly, because Rabbi Mazuz signed a letter together with Rav Avadya Tat Rav Amsalam, and Rav Mazuz said that we too reject what he says. Rabbi Mazuz never would go against Rav Avad Yosef. Rav Mazuz is a big right winger. To show you the respect, even though Rav Avadya was agreed for the Oslo Accords and was willing to give back land, Rav Mazuz never would publicly say anything about against him. Never. He was because he felt that he was the greatest of the generation. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, that you don't say your own views. But now, after Rav Avad Yosef has passed away, Rav Mazuz says his piece, and that's why there's big machokas between Rav Yitzhak Yosef, the Rishon Lezion, and Rav Mazuz. And just, in my opinion, all you have to do is read the, if you read their weekly Torah things, all Rav Yitzhak Yosef can do, and he's one of the great poskim of our time. Can't take that away from him. Yalkut Yosef, it's such a standard work, but he can only speak halacha. That's it. Every week. You read Rav Mazuz's thing, it's all over the place. Parshanut, poetry, this and that. But I want to show you something, which is from 3 years, even after Rav Mazuz publicly had to say that we reject Rabbi Amsalam. Hold on, is it here? Here. Here's when I visited Rabbi Mazuz. This is in 2017. I want to enlarge this now. Everyone, I think, should be able to see the books right there. Zera Yisrael and Makor Yisrael. So right on his shelf. I want to read you what Rabbi Mazuz says. This is a sort of thing that some would regard as really problematic, but listen to what he says. This is it's a lengthy haskamah. He speaks about how that Ralam Salam in his book says that we have to bring the converts close as we can. This book, incidentally, is not on Otzer HaChachma. They won't put anything by Ralam Salam on there, as far as I know. He says we have to bring them close. He says that we've never. He says that we've never had a situation where people would pasul a geirus from before 30 years with the taina that the geir did not observe mitzvos. He says lo haya davar hazeh ba'olam. He says Ramazu says there never was such a thing in history, and he's right about that. And he says that we need to be careful about these sorts of conversions because we can't convert people who don't want to have any connection with Judaism. But then he says, the Shulchan Aruch tells us, we tell the Ger, what do we tell him? A few of the small mitzvos and a few of the big mitzvos. The Rambam says, you tell a convert a few small mitzvos and a few big mitzvos. A few, what does it mean, a small mitzvah? The Rambam says that one of the small mitzvos is speaking Hebrew. That's a mitzvah. But you tell him a few of the big and a few of the small, and then you convert him. There's no Beis Din in the world that does that. They give them year-long courses. They have to know everything. I put something on the Sfarim blog, a test of a Beis Din in Los Angeles. They're asking things where if a yeshiva bacher knows this, I'd be impressed. The different kings in Malchus Yisrael, they want to know about Tevel and Orgel and all that. I mean, I've never heard of such a thing. But then Rav Mazu says, okay, the Rambam tells us that we only give them a few of the big mitzvos and a few of the small ones. So Rav Mazu says, let's say they never told him. A guy, he's converting. They tell him about Shabbos, a couple big things, a couple small things. They don't tell about Mutzah. They don't tell him about that's actually Borer is dividing things on Shabbos. That's a Doraisa. So what happens, he says, the case. You convert someone. You don't tell him about Borer. And then the convert later on hears that it's forbidden, let's say, to do this or forbidden to carry from Rishus Yachid to Rishus Rabbi. And if you do that, you're Chayev Paris. And Skila. And then the convert says, I can't do this. This is too hard. Can you convert the, can you revoke the conversion? Ever heard such a thing? He says, you told him a few of the big ones, a few of the small. He accepted it. Then later on, he learns about certain things and says, I'm not going to do it. How could you, you can't revoke a conversion. The Gemara even speaks about someone who after the conversion worships idols. It's a valid conversion. And then Rav Mazuz brings a proof. The Rambam says as follows. Let me pull up the Rambam for you. This is an unbelievable proof of the Rambam, which everyone has to deal with. This is in Isurei Bia. It's chapter 14, Halacha. Which chapter is it? Sorry. It's not chapter 14. Chapter 13, Halacha 16. What does it say? It says Solomon converted women and married them. And then it says Samson converted women and married them. It is well known that they converted only because of an ulterior motive and that their conversion was not under the guidance of the court. Hence, the Tanakh considers it as if they were Gentiles or remained forbidden. Moreover, their conduct ultimately revealed their initial intent, for they would worship false deities. So in other words, these people, these women, Shlomo's wives, they converted. Publicly, they said, I want to be Jewish, but privately, they still worshiped idols. But what happens? It says afterwards, so there's number 17, if you convert and then you worship idols, just like these women did, even if afterwards the convert worships false deities, he is like an apostate Jew. That is, we don't void it. He's a Jew that's worshiped idols. If he consecrates, that is, a Mekadesh, a woman, the Kedushin is valid, and it's a mitzvah to his lost subject. For since he immersed himself, he became a Jew. For this reason, Samson and Solomon maintained their wives, even though their inner feelings were revealed. In other words, despite their sins, they remained Jewesses. Even though their inner feelings, their connection to idolatry revealed. What the Rambam says is that Shlomo's wives still wanted to be idolaters. They said publicly, we want to be Jewish. But secretly, they still were attached to their idolatry. They even continued doing idolatry after they converted, and yet the Rambam says they have the status of sinning Jews because the Lashon is, even though their secret, their inner feelings were revealed, nevertheless, we only care about the publicly that they accepted Torah mitzvot. That would appear to be an unbelievable proof that even people who convert and don't have the intention of observing that they are, it's a valid conversion. So Rav Mazuz says, he goes on, he says, what you do is, if the person converts, if he's mal v'tavo, the kibur alav ager ol mitzvos ba'ofen kali. If the convert accepts, how do you translate this? Accepts mitzvot in a general sense. That is, I'm gonna try to do the best I can, or something like that. Rav Mazuz says, dayo b'chach. This is enough. You don't need to. And he goes on. He says, oh, this way he says. And when you teach the future converts, don't teach them inyanei pruzbo, mechira chametz, or things like this. I mean, this is not what you teach converts. So what you have here of Mazuz, the great Rav Mazuz, a very liberal perspective on how to deal with converts. And you can't say that this is not an acceptable, this is, maybe it's not what people today do in our circles, but to say that this is Michutz L'machana, or this is reformist, or open orthodoxy, or anything, impossible. This is Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski. He had a big debate with the Dvar Avraham of Kovno. Rav Chaim Ozer thought that if someone converts, and then they say, well, you know, I'm not strong enough, I violate Shabbos if I need to, well, it's still a valid conversion. The Dvar Avraham of Kovno said, what are you talking about? How could it be a valid conversion? If beforehand they know that they're going to convert, and they're going to, before they convert, they know they're going to violate it, how can it be a valid conversion? Rav Chaim Ozer thought, as long as they weren't doing it lahachis, they were just doing it with te'avon. And Rav Chaim Ozer thought, it's not a structural matter. So, for example, you can't convert, according to Rav Chaim Ozer, if you're a pilot, and you're scheduled next Shabbos to fly an airplane. Because then it's, but if in general you convert, trying to do your best, but you know that at times you're not going to be able to do it, but you accept it. You just might not live up to it. Chaim Ozer thought that that was valid, and Rav Yoshev in one place says that that's what the Israeli Batei Din used to rely on. Now, when we meet next class, which I think now is going to be in 2 weeks, but you'll get an email about it, I want to read to you what will he see what Rav Amsalam says, and I'll read you what I wrote to him and what he wrote to me. It's a short tshuva, but again, expanding on this thing, his approach to conversion and what is required. We have an interesting situation in Israel now because you have this independent Beis Din, which was led by Rav Rabinovich, and now it's Rabbi Amsalam, Rabbi Riskin's on it, and others. I think Rabbi Stav is on it, the head of Tzohar, and they're converting people not within the Rabbanut. So I heard Rabbi Stav, and he had a debate with Rav Moshe Lichtenstein. Rav Moshe Lichtenstein is more conservative with a small c when it comes to conversion. And Rabbi Stav says, he was asked, well, what about the fact that the Rabbanut doesn't recognize them? Rabbi Stav says, the Rabbanut doesn't recognize the converts from Rabbi Karelitz's based in B'nai Brak either. They wouldn't recognize Satmar converts. He says, Judaism is not about what the Rabbanut recognizes. And in the end, he says, the Rabbanut will recognize them because this is a valid based in and they're valid converts. So Rabbi Amsalam is involved with this effort. So we'll see that. Another thing for my fine handler, and we'll probably finish Yoredeya next time. It ends with aspects of the Rambam and superstition, and what Rav Chaim Rapoport has to say about that. So let me look at the comments and the questions here, and thank you all for coming. Baruch says it's lonely at the top. CEOs are also lonely. Geniuses in general are lonely because it's hard for them to find people to speak to about the things that matter to them. Obviously, the geniuses can speak about other things, but the things that really matter to them, it's hard for them. I know, Barry, you should type out your question again. I don't know what it is. Barry says, Rav Yosef Weiss was Rosh Hashir for 75 years. I said 60, 75 years. Very nice. The Rav asked him to teach Yoredeya. Rav Weiss told us he was Zocha to say Chazar Hashir for both Rav Moshe and the Rav. Rav Weiss was the last, he might have been the last person alive to Rav Musmach of the YU to Yeshiva's Rav Chanan to also be a Talmud of Rav Moshe. I don't know, Rabbi Klapperman, Gil Klapperman passed away before him. I'm not sure. Yes, Baruch says old time Sephardim didn't go to same gender weddings. Of course not. But you have to. He doesn't come from a Torah background. And that's why it's really interesting. Yes, Sosbach says, I believe Rabbi Israel wrote on Zeri Yisrael well. Exactly. Thank you, Rabbi Yechavin, to what I said. Later on, Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer was opposed to this conception of Zeri Yisrael. Rav Zvi Hirsch Kalischer supported it. And most people accepted Rav Hildesheimer's idea. There isn't a notion of Zera Yisrael, but you have certain people who do think it is. Is it usher to give Mila to a non-Jewish child? Well, that's the question. The Rambam says you can give to Muslims, but just he has this interesting understanding of B'nai Yishmael. But Svi Hirsch Kavosher and others held that the father's Jewish and the mother's not Jewish, and the father wants to bring the child to be can have a circumcision, even though the child's not converting, you can do that because you want the child to eventually convert, and this will make it easier. Rav Zera Hildesheimer said, how can you do that? The child then is going to assimilate, especially in Europe. In Europe, the only people who were circumcised were Jews. So here you have a child who's not Jewish, who's circumcised. How long is it going to be until he starts thinking himself as Jewish or other people? And he has the proof. The proof is in his body. And that's going to lead to intermarriage. So how can you convert people? How can you give people Mila so people then think that they're converted? I don't know if that won't be an issue. I don't know if in America, because a lot of people are circumcised who are not. But that's a big dispute. I don't know today what the post scheme hold. If you have a situation where you have a Jew, you have many, obviously, Jewish fathers, non-Jewish mothers, and the father, he might have intermarried, but he knows it. He might, first of all, be patrilineal-minded, so he thinks his son is Jewish. And second of all, he might believe that it's still important to give the child a circumcision. So let's say you're the Moel. I've been to many relatives' circumcisions, and with only one exception where they had this woman, Moel, who's a conservative rabbi, all the Moelim have been Orthodox rabbis. Or I shouldn't say rabbis, Orthodox Moelim. So you're a Moel. Do Moels ask... do we have any moles on with us? If a mole gets a call to do a circumcision, is it like when the kid goes to school? Do you ask that, is your mother Jewish or anything? You just go and you do it. Do we ask questions? I don't know if they ask questions. And should they ask, if they know the child is not halachically Jewish, they get there and they see that the mother's maiden name is Marioni or something, do they then say, I can't do it? If anyone has any knowledge of that, I'd love to know. Shmuley says the Machina in Telsh was a gymnasium. I never heard that. The Machina there had no segregation. No, I never said the Machina was a gymnasium. I said there was a gymnasium in Telsh, and there was also a Machina. The Machina was a place there was a high school, by the way, for girls. The Machina was before yeshiva, but they and the girls' school, they spoke secular. They spoke Hebrew. They even used the Israeli flag. And there was a Yavna school in Tels, and Yavna had secular studies. I believe the Machina had secular studies as well. I have to check that. But Dr. Yitzchak Etzion, Holzer Etzion, was the head of the Machina. And they certainly did have secular studies of the Machina in Tels. But that's not what I meant by the gymnasium. I meant there separately. Rav Lichtenstein's mother, I think, went to the, if I'm not mistaken, went there. And... I wrote about the Yavna system. The Yavna system was very strong in Tels, and that had secular studies. The Machina might, I think, was even associated with the Yavna system. But I have to look back. What does it mean to accept mitzvot without committing to keep them? Well, two things. First of all, another question is the Rambam says if the conversion is valid if they don't tell you. Is it the Rambam? The Shulchan Aruch says if they don't tell you what the mitzvot are, that is, you accept them but they don't tell you. What does that mean? It could mean, some people think it means that you don't even know about the mitzvot. It's still valid ex post facto. Others means it means you accept in the general sense. That is, if you say, I accept the mitzvot. I don't know any of the mitzvot, but whatever they are, I'll do them. So that's acceptance of the mitzvot without knowing them. Now, acceptance of the mitzvot without committing to keep them is what Rav Uziel says. They tell you that these are the mitzvot. But does a mitzvah, you have to eat kosher. And you say, yes, I acknowledge there is a mitzvah. If I eat non-kosher, I understand that I will be punished. God will punish me. It's the wrong thing to do. Jews need to keep kosher, but I'm telling you that I'm not so religious. That already is a bridge too far for me. I'll do Shabbos and I'll do Yom Kippur, but I know someone who basically is kosher, or so he said, except for my parents around, they know I'm speaking about. He at home, he's kosher. Sort of, but he says Chinese food he can't. Chinese food he can't. That's, he wants real Chinese food. So someone converts and they say, I'll keep a kosher home, but I need to go out every now and then with my parents. They love to go to this non-kosher Chinese restaurant. So you're accepting it as a mitzvah and you're accepting what you're doing is wrong. But nevertheless, your attitude is, lots of people, all my friends do things that are wrong. they're Jews, so I can't. Ramosha even holds that if all your surrounding, all the people in your area violate a certain commandment, that's not considered you not accepting it, because you're just doing like all the other Jews are doing. So that would be an example, and Rav Uziel takes us to an extreme, that you don't really need to commit to do anything as long as you recognize that this is what the Torah wants and you accept that you're a sinner if you don't. That's a lean, a very liberal view. Most people are in the middle somewhere. That doesn't mean you commit to have to do every single thing, but you're sort of in the middle. Baruch says, yeah, of course, Sfardim can go to soccer games on Shabbos, but they'll be more conservative on other things. I remember when I first worked among the Syrians, I worked one summer in Deal. They were so mocked on certain things, like a Tani's Esther and little fast days. Everyone will fast. They'll take it very seriously. But on other matters that are really halacha, it was sort of like a cultural thing. Ms. Barbara says, in Europe, royalty circumcised their males. In England, they did. Is that the case everywhere in Europe? I know that in England, they did. They used to have to use the Jewish Moloch. But that's already a question of fear of the Malchus. You can't tell them. It's a famous, someone wrote it up when it was Nathan Adler was chief rabbi with Queen Victoria. So, but that was, I don't know if it's all Europe. I'd be surprised if it was all Europe, but it was definitely England or maybe the royal family that the these interlopers in England come from Germany, right? Shmoy said the Reverend Telsh was Yosef Leiblach. He was the supporter of Yavna Girls School. Okay, the Machine, you say, was part of the Yeshiva, not Philly yet, but I'm pretty certain that they taught secular studies in there. But in any event, there was it was a very Zionistic place. The school, quasi-Zionist. As I said, they used Hebrew and they had the Israeli, they used the Zionist flag, although they called it the national flag or something like that. And I'm pretty positive that they had, but I'll check that for next week about the secular studies in Machina. I did a whole blog post on when I dealt with some of that, but Shmuley, you might. It's funny because we think of Telz as being very radical. When it came to America, it was on the right-wing extreme of Haredi Judaism. You couldn't go in the 50s, 60s, 70s, when everyone at Tarvadas and Chaim Brom were going to college at night in Telz, you were not allowed to go to university at all. So they were very strict on that. What did I do in Deal? In Deal, I was hired to be a counselor with all my friends, but I ended up being the tennis counselor, tennis. I gave tennis lessons at the camp, the big camp in Deal one summer. Sozbach says only in England are they circumcised. And also Baruch says they're circumcised. Okay, I see. And I promised Reuven, I shouldn't promise, I promised Billy Nether. We'll get to what you sent me. I want to share it about I caught up on one other thing. So the last thing I want to share is about the fasting, something fascinating. I didn't want to do it before Tisha B'Av, but I'll say it afterwards. And again, thank you all very much. The plan is at present, I will not be here next week. If there's a change, we'll send out another email, or Rabbi Kelman will send out an email saying I'm not here. Enjoy the rest of the time, and thank you all.